Welcome, everyone, to the third session about the Women's Christian Temperance Union with Professor Elaine Franz from Kent State University. Today, we're going to get beyond the U.S. and go into the world. So let's get started.
Sorry, I was okay. That might work, but I'll just start very briefly for people online. Today we're actually, Sarah was correct that today was meant to be International Day, but I've switched it so that today could be about gender. So we're gonna be talking about putting the W in the WCTU and specifically focusing more than we have so far on Frances Willard, the head of the WCTU, and her ideas about being a woman and her experience of gender, which was sort of interesting and complicated. Okay, let's see if this is. Let me try to put this guy on. Could I ask you, Ted, to advance it? Okay, and here we're going to talk about, there's going to be 5 parts to this. And it is, we're talking about whether Frank or Frances, kind of thinking about Frances's gender. And then we'll talk about crushes and wives, loving women, Frances's romantic or I'll say romantic relationships, affectionate relationships. We're talking about the trouble with husbands, according to the WCTU. It's a really, it's very different sometimes in a lot of ways than how we have thought about it. We'll be talking about motherhood. And then we'll be talking about making the world womanly, how it is that the WCTU tried to extend this sort of female world of love to sort of make the whole world better. And actually, I think we could move forward one. Is it working? Okay, let's see. Oh, it is. Okay, there we go. Okay, so here's Frances Willard. So Frances Willard was born in 1839, and she, a spoiler, was going to die pretty young. She was never not going to make it to age 60. She was going to die in the year 1898. And in those years, she lived a very unconventional life for a woman, right? First of all, she was very powerful. She was very politically powerful. She was going to end up doing a lot of sort of political lobbying. She was going to end up doing a lot of public speaking. At the time she was born, you know, it wasn't even really appropriate for women to be speaking to what they called, to sort of mixed crowds in public. And she was going to be doing a huge amount of public speaking. She was going to be a leader of a major organization. And in a whole bunch of different ways, she was going to do a lot of things that women were not allowed to do. And she was also, as she was doing it, she was going to be trying to open the door for other women to do it as well. She basically formed, if you try to understand what the WCTU was, It was the biggest national organization of women that had ever existed. And it was the biggest that ever would exist, probably till today, though I haven't compared it. We'd have to think about how to compare it to some of the sort of 60s, you know, women's organizations. But I think that probably the biggest national women's organization that we've ever had. And this women's organization had all sorts of board meetings. It had a huge budget. It did tremendous things. And in order to do that, it taught women how to do things that it wasn't new, completely new. You know, women had been involved in the abolitionist movement, and women had done some of the business of that organization. But the WCTU is going to be the first time that women are really running a national business-like organization. And they're running it all themselves. There are no men who are in leadership in the WCTU. So they had had roles in, they'd been allowed to have important roles in the abolitionist movements, but women had never really run their own major organization. And the WCTU was going to be that organization. So Frances Willard, from being a child, and she writes a wonderful memoir, which is called Glimpses of 50 Years, when she's 50. She's already one of the most famous people in the world, or at least in the country. She would soon be in the world. And so when she writes Glimpses of 50 Years, she talks a lot about herself as female and how unusual it is that she, as a woman, because that was the most interesting thing about her in a lot of ways, is that how did she do all these things as a woman? She says that from the time she was a child, she sort of wished that she had been a boy. And that this, that she felt constrained because she was a girl and she couldn't do some of the things that boys could do. And then especially as a young woman, when the Civil War came, right, and all of the young men marched off to war, you know, she very much wished, you know, she was very much an abolitionist. Her family was a family of reformers, right, anti-slavery reformers. And she very much wished, they're in Illinois, she very much wished that she could also go and fight the war, but of course she couldn't. And so one way to understand, first of all, the Temperance Crusade that was going to happen 8 years after the end of the war, right, is that this was kind of women marching off to war. And in fact, women did go. If you think about the images from the Temperance Crusade from a couple of weeks ago, women did go in ranks and they marched down the streets in a way that would have looked very much like a militia march, right, through the streets. So I think in some ways, this was women sort of replicating, you know, the thing that they were not allowed to do and spared from doing, right? Nobody wants to be a soldier, really, but, you know, spared from doing because they were female, but that they felt sort of that they had been obligated to do. So she liked, and then when Frances became a college student, she did go to college, which was not that unusual for elite young women like she was. But when she did go to college, and when she was in college, she took the name Frank. She was often known by her friends as Frank, and which was common at the time. A lot of young women in colleges, in particular, like to take male names. She was a person who, in many ways, thought of herself as moving into sort of a male space. Okay. And at this time, you actually had, and we think about what's going on today, so much changes with gender now, right? That's kind of confusing. I think in the last 10 years, it's like, what's even happening, right? But there's actually a lot of precedence to this. So in the 19th century, the late 19th century, it was pretty common for women to cross-dress. And this was particularly true on the stage. And this is the most famous woman cross-dresser. Her name was Ella Wessner. She always posed as a man. She went, you know, she would have called herself Ella. She would have, you know, said that she was female. But she always took male roles on the stage. But this was very, very common to have a female performers dressing as male at this time. And incidentally, what these women tended to sing, there was a particular kind of performance they tended to give, and Ella Wessner in particular, this was her specialty. They tended to sing in the persona of drunken men. Right? So they would dress up like this and they'd be like, I'm a member of the Late Late Club and I love to, like, you know, cuddle with all the girls and I love to da da da. And they would have this, but they tended to take the position of rakes or gents, you know, or something kind of like young men going out for fun, drinking too much. And they would make a lot of jokes about how much they drank. You know, I've had 30 and I'm getting ready for 31 or whatever, you know, that this would be the kind of thing that she was always singing. And there were many like her. So it was very socially normal on the stage to do that. But actually, it was very socially normal in women's groups, and particularly collegiate level, you know, women going to college. It was very common for women to cross-dress, like have a day when they're all dressing as men or something like that. And in fact, when I first started to teach, I was in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And I said, I was teaching at University of Wisconsin, Oshkosh. And I went out to look at their archives. And I was always interested in the WCTU. So I was looking at a scrapbook of one of the WCTU reformers. And I said, oh, what's this group of young men, you know, who's like posing for this picture? And of course, it was all the reforming women of Oshkosh, and they were dressed as men. And they were taking a really cute picture, you know, young women. And, you know, it was play. But I also just really can't emphasize enough how central to the culture it was. And a lot of women dressing as men, but it was also very common at this time. We won't be talking about this because it's outside of our scope. It was also very common for things to go the other way, right? So if you went to a minstrel show, which is huge at this time, probably the most famous, most important, widespread form of public entertainment, not only were people cross-racially dressed in that they were wearing blackface, you know, and mocking, you know, people of color, but they were also cross-gender dressed. You know, it was very, very common at this time on the minstrel show. Usually all the people in the troupe were white men, and they portrayed all sorts of people, right? You know, any sort of, you know, all both genders and all races, right? So they were cross-dressing a lot on the stage. But so this is very, very common at the time. And let's see. Okay. But in addition to this, Frances Willard had intimate, loving relationships throughout her life with women, and only with women. So she's going to, throughout her life, have a series of monogamous relationships with women. And we can't know, because she doesn't really tell us in her memoirs exactly, you know, what the specific physical content of those relationships are. But she, referring to her younger self in her biography, Glimpses of 50 Beautiful Years, Frances Willard refers to her younger self as, quote, and she's talking to her about, when she talks about her younger self, she talks in the third person. When she's talking about herself as a teenager or a young woman, she refers to Frances Willard, she did this, she did that, even though she's writing it herself. She said, I could be relied upon to prevent my fellow students from flirting with the boys. A young man would have been temerity himself who would have suggested such a thing to her, to Frances. If a young man would have attempted to date her, it would have been temerity itself. In fact, Frances came to be something of a beau herself. This again is in her own words. She was herself a beau. A certain dashing recklessness about her, having as much fascination for the average schoolgirl as if she had been a senior in the university. So she was so dashing herself that she appealed to the younger students, the younger female students, as though she was a male senior. She was known to take on the airs of a bandit or a pirate. Girls at the time, she said, would have said of me, she's wild with the girls and doesn't care a snap for the boys. Okay. So she's really pretty direct here about where her interests lie. Yes. She never married though. So I actually don't know. That's really interesting. But yeah, she did never marry. So I'm not sure how to explain that ring. So she said, there's various quotes that I kind of grabbed out of her memoir preparing for this. But she said, when she was in college in Evanston, she said, "I once fell in love with a very bright, attractive, but reckless young schoolmate for whom I conceived a romantic attachment, although she was, quote, the wildest girl in school." She referred to another girl at school as her inamorata. So these aren't like, people reading between the lines here. This is her, very much having a sort of physical affection and romantic affection for these girls. She says, and she would actually talk about, she would write to female friends, talk about how much she looked forward to sharing a bed with them, and whispering into their ears, in the bed, and things like that. So it was very, she had an intimate physical relationship of love, right? With several women, girls in her youth, but then also women over time. And one of the fascinating things about the WCTU, I have to say, I've fallen in love a little bit with Frances Willard. I mean, she's just a sort of enormously charismatic and compelling person. But women fell in love with her all the time. She would have these love letters from adult women like throughout her life that were just enormously, affectionate. They're fan letters, right? But they're just really very, they're very affectionate towards her. And I wanna move this forward. Thank you. And I don't see particular stories from the, her affections somewhere. But this is like during the time when she's there, and this is a kind of world of affection. Yes. Oh, thank you. This is kind of the world of affection that she was an important part of. Okay, and what she was kind of like. Yes. Oh, no, this is not our Pittsburgh. This is the Pittsburgh Female Seminary, which then was closed down and became Beaver College. And then it became something else and was ultimately moved toward close to Philly. So it no longer exists here. But it's the Pittsburgh Female Seminary that she taught at briefly at the time of the Women's Crusades. But I have this as just kind of an example of the sort of female world of affection that she was part of, the sort of, the love that these women showed to each other and the sort of support that they found among their female friends. Hey, Frances Willard, in having female friendships, close female intimate friendships at this time, she was not that unusual. Particularly compared to other reforming women. And so if you think about somebody, how many people are familiar with Jane Addams? Jane Addams, she set up something called the Hull House in Chicago, which was a really important, it's called a settlement house. She never married, right? She lived in the settlement house with reforming women, right? And they tried to take care of poor immigrants in Chicago, right? It's right at the same time. But Jane Addams, you could trace her throughout her life. She had female, always one female partner that she was very close to. And then they would fall out and she would have another female partner, that she was very close to for several years. And then they would fall out. She had another female partner. But she always had exactly one female partner that she was particularly close to. She always lived with that person and she never lived with anybody else, right? Or we have just a diary here from just a young woman named Christine Ladd, and she talks about she talks about her love, the loves in her life, and she decides that this man named Mr. Sherman is courting her, but she confesses in her diary, "I do not like Mr. Sherman fully." However, in her next entry, she wholeheartedly declares her love for a girl named Ava Well. She gushed, "I have declared my passion and my mistress loves me. Ava is my love. I slept with her one night. We remained awake many hours confessing our love. Ah, I cannot say how much I love her, better than anyone in the world. She is beautiful, a skin fair as the foam of the sea, eyelids that droop and flutter and triumph and then rest lovingly over the witching orbs beneath. She said in her deep, earnest voice, I never loved anyone as I love you, Kitty. Oh, can I believe it? It is true that anyone can love me, homely, wicked as I am. I have had my lady loves before, but I have worshipped at a distance, made happy by a smile, intoxicated by a kind word dropped carelessly. But never have I had the exquisite joy of love returned. Now I know what is meant by the ecstasy of a kiss. Ah, why is it we have no words given us to express the things we feel so deeply? So these were very pretty common and widespread experiences, particularly for women, college women, some of whom were at the women's colleges where it was very pronounced, right? But some of whom, were also going to the state universities. But again, a very sort of common part of life. Now, did people worry about this? Was this seen as problematic? Not really. And that's because in the Victorian era, there was an idea that women were not very sexual, right? The sexuality came from men. Women would prefer not to have sex, even within marriage. The idea the Victorians often thought of was that women consented to sex, in order to reproduce, but that they didn't actually themselves, unless there was something wrong with them, they didn't themselves enjoy sex, right? And so to imagine two women having a sexual relationship wasn't something that scared them in the 19th century, because it would be impossible, right? It's not something that could happen. And so because of that sort of belief about sort of women's not having sort of sexual desire, there really wasn't too much concern about very close, intimate relationships between women. And in fact, what most people believed, and people talked about this, is that these close, intimate relationships between women were preparing women for later marriage, that they were kind of teaching them, how to have these sort of loving, monogamous relationships so that they would be prepared later to have a sort of marriage with a man. Okay, and this is just, I wanted to just show a picture of, a lot of the WCTU women and kind of the pleasure that they found with their relationships. And this is Frances Willard with one of her two last close relationships. And this is with Anna Gordon, who is going to also replace her as president after her death. They lived together for many years, Frances Willard and Anna Gordon. Okay, so the trouble with husbands. This is a piece of 1872 temperance sheet music, called The Cup of Woe. And I wanted to use it to illustrate the WCTU is sort of WCTU critiques of men. Of course, it's central to what they're doing, right? Everything the WCTU does is about what's wrong with men, right? But it's interesting, the WCTU tends to say, and other temperance people, they have a different message than what, say, the suffrage movement is saying. What the suffrage movement at this time is saying is that the problem is domineering men, right? The problem is that men don't give women space for, full personhood. And sort of any sort of, power within relationships. That's the suffrage line. The temperance people are saying something different. The temperance people tend to be saying, and Frances Willard as well, that the problem with men is that they're not very good at their job, right? The problem with men is that they sort of fail to be good patriarchs, right? And the temperance movement itself, one reason that it becomes so widespread is it doesn't seem quite so radical as the suffrage movement. Because what they're actually saying is, men aren't being good patriarchs, and our job is to restore them to their proper role within the family, right? In order to do that, you have to give us a little bit of power, but we're going to use our power to actually bring back, bring back the, the sort of norm that we should have, right? But in fact, and that is, you know, that is very much her rhetoric. And what ends up happening is the WCTU becomes a much more powerful voice for women's rights than the suffrage movement does, because his message tends to be less radical. They're like, give us the vote so that we can restore things, so that men can have their proper space within the family. But they're really calling for the, you know, the same vote, but they're saying we're going to use it for basically conservative ends to restore the family. But Frances Willard herself, she seems to perhaps have some of the ideas of the suffrage movement. She actually really hates being dominated by men. And in fact, there's a great story here where she does once get engaged. So she gets engaged when she's pretty young, to a man named Charles Fowler. He's the president of Northwestern University, where she studies and then becomes a dean. She's the dean of women there. So they're in relationship both as a fiancés and also as sort of employer and employee. They are engaged, and she ultimately breaks the engagement with him, in part because she seems to be in love with his sister. You know, she's sharing a bed with his sister. You know, she's very affectionate with his sister, and ultimately she decides she can't get married and she breaks the engagement. But she's still working for him, right, as a sort of dean of women. And at one point he humiliates her. There's a public meeting. It was very relatable. I don't know how many of us, you know, are or were professional women, but like, it was very, in a very relatable scene, he's disrespectful to her in a meeting in a way that embarrasses her. And she comes home and says, I wept hot tears, you know, after this meeting, and she quits. She won't work for him any longer. But so she has a problem with men as husbands, you know, but she also has a problem with men as attempting to dominate her. And this brings us to our last scene. So, motherhood, our last two. Frances Willard never becomes a mother, obviously. But Frances Willard always uses the rhetoric of motherhood. Frances Willard loves, in many ways, being female. She loves identifying as a woman. In many ways, she always thinks of herself as a mother, and a lot of people call her a mother. A lot of women in the temperance union, the Women's Christian Temperance Union, get called like Mother Fowler or Mother this or Mother that. And the rhetoric of motherhood is very big. Frances Willard is considered sort of the universal mother, mother to all, you know, who she's assisting, right? And so there's a lot of rhetoric of femininity that she still uses and sort of taps into. Here's her with Anna Gordon. This is Frances at the top with Anna Gordon, her life partner, and with her own mother, who gets called Saint Courageous, Mother Willard, Saint Courageous. And they bring out her mother, Frances Willard's mother, a lot, and sort of make this big deal about the kind of bond between mother and child. But then also Frances Willard, while she doesn't have her own children, women around the country name their children Frances Willard. And this is just a tiny little, the pictures that Anna Gordon put together of after Frances Willard's death, of all the children who were named, all the babies who were named after her, you know, that were one particular age. But it's all over the place. When you look at records, census records, a lot of people, like thousands of people, name their children after women, right? You know, probably, right? Name their children after Frances Willard. She wasn't herself a mother, but she was very much seen as sort of a maternal figure. So she's not just rejecting the idea of womanhood, she's embracing it. This is my favorite Frances Willard. James Cagney's wife was named Billy Vernon, but her actual name was Frances Willard Vernon. But just, you know, a lot of people, you know, named in honor of Frances Willard. Which brings us to the last part here. Frances Willard, and the whole point of the WCTU, is to bring women's special influence and sort of womanliness to bear on the world, to make the world more womanly, to bring the power of womanliness to the nation, and then ultimately, as we'll see next week, to the world, in such a way as to make it a kinder and more generous and more supportive world. And I have an example of this. You know, of course, women go out in public and they sort of make themselves known in the public sphere to sort of bring women's influence there. And that's part of what the WCTU is all about. But I have a story that that really strikes me about it. And that is the WCTU lobbies Congress a lot. Like they end up and Frances Willard finds herself frequently in the halls of Congress, you know, lobbying for this or that. When she first goes, she says the Congress building was thoroughly distasteful, almost sickening to us by reason of the sight of the many much used spittoons and the sight and smell of the blue cloud of smoke. We women sat in one corner on a sofa feeling very much like mariners stranded on a lee shore. And they actually, so she complains about this and the Congress actually gives the women their own room in the building and they bring in flowers. Everybody sends them flowers and they make it like the most feminine possible space, right, within the Congress building. Like, and so their idea is to like, you know, make the world itself and make the halls up more feminine, not only by voting, but by just bringing all this influence. They set up their own newspaper, the Union Signal, right? And the Union Signal is largely gonna tell temperance news, but the Union Signal, it also gets delivered to your house and it can be the way that you sort of interact through the world, right? It's a women's newspaper. It runs for many years and it's kind of a way to sort of like absorb the entire world, right? Through the sort of the gaze of women and the temperance movement. And then the most impressive thing that they did you know this? They built a skyscraper. They did build a skyscraper. It's called the Women's Temple. It was built in Chicago and it was built in 1892. And the idea was that it would be, you know, a skyscraper for women's work, but that they would also lease out, like all the skyscrapers did, the space in that skyscraper, and that would form a permanent financial base for the continuing women's work. They raised all the money, they built the skyscraper, and it was at LaSalle and Monroe Street, if you're familiar with Chicago, and just the first two stories of this were built of gray granite with a dash of pink. It had eight elevators. It had 13 stories. It was a beautiful building and they knocked it down during the New Deal era. But for a long time, it was a very successful and beautiful skyscraper. And that brings us, you know, basically to the end. But what I wanted to say was that the women's end of the WCTU is sort of very complicated, but very important. You know, this was kind of taking on the problem of what is women's role in this world? You know, can women claim power in this world? What does it mean to be female? You know, what do we do with the problem of, you know, our domination by men, right? How do we navigate that? How do we try to deal with that? And Frances Willard was enormously successful at trying to do that. So that's it.
Okay. Thank you. In my own life, when I finished college and when I, you know, finished all of that, then it was a good time to go to work. But at that time, there was no arrangement for children. And so it was, as a matter of fact, it was even looked down upon for a woman to go into the workplace if there were small children. And so I'm just wondering, there's no mention here of these women, they have their own children? And if so, how was that accommodation made? And what was the public view of that? I mean, were they scorned for leaving children at home or with somebody else, a babysitter? I have no idea. I can't picture what that would be like. So can you say a word or two about that?
Yeah, I have actually a few things. first of all, Frances Willard, of course, didn't have children. And she's not alone in the WCTU leadership. Like Anna Gordon didn't have children. Now, one, somebody might say, you know, a lot of the leadership were lesbians, right? And that gave them the time, right? And the child-freeness to allow them to take these powerful positions. And that is kind of, you know, the term lesbian didn't exist at the time, but I have to say that that doesn't seem far from the truth, right? I think that part of what happened is that a lot of these women, or either for whatever reason, didn't partner, didn't have children. And that was also true even outside of the temperance movement and things like the Settlement House movement and things like that, that you had a lot of college women who chose not to marry and chose not to have children, right? And they became the core of the leadership. Now, women with children, one thing the WCTU did was it fought hard for kindergartens, right? So the WCTU was really invested in the kindergarten movement. I don't think that Frances Willard would have approved of women leaving their children at home before kindergarten. I can't find the time. If I had to guess, I would say she would probably have said, if you're having children, you need to stay home for a few years. But she also did want, you know, she wanted to set up things like kindergartens, but she was never particularly, the WCTU never really was pushing for daycare-like structures. The settlement houses sometimes took care of little children while their moms worked. And that was at the same time. That's what Jane Addams is doing. But I don't really think, I can't think of an example that for like a daycare-like thing. Yeah. So good question. Yeah.
I find myself wondering about the prompts or the motivations for the WCTU in these movements. To what extent was it a response to the patriarchy? To what extent was it a response to the ideas of the Victorian era? To what extent was it a response to some women with very strong personalities and drive to make a mark on the world?
Yeah, this is actually something I struggle with a little bit because I don't like great man history. And in fact, I just wrote like a really nasty, not nasty, but a little aggressive book review about, you know, there's a big book about, you know, how Grant, you know, killed the Ku Klux Klan. And I'm like, you know what? It wasn't Grant. It was like everybody, you know, a lot of people worked on that. It wasn't just Grant. We don't need to just highlight. But you just heard me, like, I am just so enamored of Frances Willard, right? And I really feel like Frances Willard was a sort of great man, you know, like it's hard not to see her in that light, you know. So to what extent was this just, you know, Frances Willard, who was clearly enormously capable and visionary person? And to what extent was this just a social movement that was bound to happen, right? Because women were getting more education, because women were having fewer kids, you know, by this point, you know, there was cash, you know, people had a lot more time for social movements and money for social movements and were able to do the things they had to do. So I don't know. I feel like it was a movement whose time had come, but I think they needed a leader like Frances Willard. Would somebody else have emerged if it wasn't Frances Willard? You know, I suspect so, right? But they needed somebody like Frances Willard. Yeah.
Other questions? Anybody online? Lots of food for thought here. Wow.
My students, because I'm teaching this now to a class of, you know, sort of 20-year-olds in Ohio. We haven't gotten to this yet, but we'll get to this. Right now we're just at the 1840s, 1850s, right? But they're so fascinated by this because their world of gender they're experiencing is so different than the one I was raised in. And it's fascinating for them to look back and see, actually, there's been a lot of sort of fluctuation, you know, in ideas about gender over time, which I think is something that I hadn't even really realized until I was able to see it. you know, kind of all of the changes now sort of bring me back to be able to see what was happening in the 19th century.
Not to monopolize, but it just occurs to me, looking at the Women's Temple and seeing some things about music and all, and I wonder, was there, what did the church, how did the church view this movement?
The church loved the movement. And that was the thing, is that when I say nobody was, you know, people made fun of like Boston marriages. You ever heard the term Boston marriage before? So at the time there was like people like these Boston marriages, which are two women living together, right?
And there is this nowadays, there's this giant rise up about the homosexuality and all. And so
there was not a moral object. Like you really didn't hear. People were like these Boston marriages, but the problem wasn't that the women were doing something shady or problematic or immoral, right? Because that just wasn't something that people really thought was likely. That wasn't the problem. The problem was that they were not having kids and they weren't marrying men. So for instance, you're going to get, you know, you think about Theodore Roosevelt, it's right at the end of the 1890s that he begins talking about, you know, the problem is that like the most eugenics, we're about ready to move into the eugenics movement, right? The most fit to reproduce women aren't reproducing, right? So they're, you know, and instead like all these like, you know, unfit people, you know, are having lots of kids, but like the college women mm-hmm. are choosing not to reproduce, right? And that's when the Boston marriages, like Frances Willard and her, that's when that starts to become a problem. Not because there's anything immoral about what they're doing, it's because they're refusing to enter into motherhood.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I guess from the male perspective in this generation, I guess I don't understand why they would exclude men and not want men to be a part of their organization at all. If your goal is to be accepted and to have people supporting you to reach the goals, which are well worthy goals. I'm not saying that suffrage and other things weren't worthy goals. Why would you openly work to exclude men?
Yeah, that's a really good point. And we haven't even talked, I've like not talked about race at all here either. I mean, this is also very much a movement of white women. There's a couple of exceptions, but why work to exclude men?
Maybe I'm not characterizing that right.
But yeah.
The way it's being presented today, I haven't heard a man there. Not one male that was part of it, not one husband that was part of it. Maybe there were no husbands that were.
They were not allowed. Men were not allowed to join or lead this movement. You're right. And that's after the Women's Crusades, where men were actually very important in supporting the Women's Crusades. I think that the concern, her concern, she wanted this to be, and that's kind of what I want to say. She wanted this to be a world of women she was building. So she wanted to keep men out. However, she worked closely and had many friends and allies who were male. She was a big pro-labor person. She actually fought for like the Labor Party and actually went to like conventions for Labor Party and stuff like that. She was sort of like romantically connected, I think falsely, with Eugene V. Debs, you know. But like, you know, she was, but she did have close allies who were leaders of men's movements, you know, or movements which were dominated by men, like the labor movement. So she worked with men and she did acknowledge that, but she wanted a space that was only women. And that's really kind of what I'm saying, that she felt this need for a women's, an exclusive women's space where women could be completely comfortable and completely empowered.
That would be skewered, wouldn't it? Everybody's talking about, you know, bring people together, not apart.
And I have to say, there wasn't much an objection to that either. Like, you know, just like there was an objection to like, well, what are these women doing? Is there some sort of like sexual more immorality, right? Which just wasn't a thing. Very few people said, oh, you should let men into the women's movement. That really wasn't interestingly, because that makes sense. Like, I hear what you're saying. And now that makes sense. But at that time, I think because women were so disempowered. Like nobody particularly worried. Like there wasn't like this movement that said like, why aren't they letting men join? Like I never have seen anyone at the time saying you should let men join the movement. That wasn't seen as a problem then. But I agree with you that it would be today. Yeah, no, I think you're totally right. But maybe because women were so oppressed, you know, relatively speaking, or had so little power even compared to women today, that it wasn't seen as a threat, or it was kind of seen more like a novelty, you know, rather than like a real threat, maybe. But that's a really good question. Yeah.
So two questions. One related to what Chip just said. I'm wondering if there's not an element of, in that context, the sphere of women and the sphere of men were viewed as so entirely separate that it's like, well, of course they're doing their own thing. And of course men aren't going to be part of it. And of course, men are not going to want to be part of it because women and men live in separate spheres and move in separate spheres. And, you know, it's like not even conceivable.
That's a good answer too, though I want to point out that part of what she's doing is she's moving the women into the men's sphere, right? But she's kind of doing it. She's doing something really complicated. She's kind of doing it in a bubble, right? She's like, we're going to go to Congress. We're going to be among the spittoons. We're going to walk into the saloon, right? But we're going to do it in this bubble of women, right? And we're going to build that, you know, if you're familiar with Chicago, that skyscraper that they built was right in the business district of Chicago, which Chicago was the most male city in the country too. Chicago was the muscle city, right? And like she happened to be from Illinois, you know, but I think it's significant that she's like, we're gonna stick a women's skyscraper, right? You know, which is how it was categorized, a 13-story building, you know, right in the middle of the most masculine space. And we're gonna put a bank in it, and we're gonna like, you know, it was like the most, we're going to have a board of directors, and we're going to like, so it's kind of like, we're going to be all women, but we're also going to be right in your space. So she's doing something with spheres. Like, I think she's challenging spheres, but she's also, I think you're totally right that there was this perception, you know, of sort of women's purity, you know, that like women are just going to like somehow stay pure from this or separate from this influence.
And so that was the second question that I had, was I'm wondering if it was true then that there were severe restrictions on property and financial asset ownership for women that got in the way of building this women's temple, or was that a phenomenon of a different era? I mean, I just don't know how in a world where women aren't really kept from owning property, how do you build a skyscraper in the midst of this very male city?
Well, my fiance, as of 2 days ago, my fiance said, you know, was like, well, who built the building? A bunch of women, you know. Like, well, I imagine. He said that once, yeah. He's still like very much in good favor I really think, you know, first of all, men contributed a lot of money, like Marshall Fields contributed a lot of money to the building, right? So, you know, men were definitely, and a lot of the women who were sort of major figures in the WCTU, I talked about how a lot of them were single, but a lot of them also were the spouses of very powerful men, right? And who were able to like spend the money, you know, that these men, you know, had. But also the one thing that the WCTU had done itself in the early 1870s was fight for married women's property laws. So the WCTU itself, and they maybe in Illinois, had actually made it possible starting in the 1870s and the 1880s, had made it possible for women to control their own money. They actually lobbied for and were important in pushing for the successful passage of married women's property laws the decade earlier. So I'm not quite sure about the timing of the Illinois law, but I will say that largely because of the advocacy of the WCTU, women could control their own property starting in the late 19th century. So this may well have been benefiting in part from that, but they probably did hire men to build the building.
I was wondering, when it first started, was it kind of like the men were patting the women on the head and saying, yeah, you know, go ahead and see what you want to get involved in, because it's not going to be a big deal, not realizing, of course, that it would become a big deal. And the other thing was, you said that the women's temple was destroyed. Was the entire area destroyed, or was this one in particular destroyed?
I don't know much about the destruction of the temple. I've gotten really interested in it, like as of like this week, as I was looking back, and I'm like, I wonder, you know, there was some dispute. It was said at the time, as a single building, it was destroyed. It was said to be, I hate to say this, but structurally unsound, probably because men built it. But it was said to be structurally unsound, you know, but then there was some debate about whether it was structurally unsound. It was very beautiful. Apparently it was architecturally, and the inside too, they had like fountains with like girls, you know, with like water. And it was just like, apparently it was just a very, very beautiful building, but there was a belief that it was a ruling even, I think, that it was structurally unsound in the 1930s.
But I wonder if, like you sort of said, if this was the only one, or one of very few that were destroyed, people can always find things if they're looking for it, you know, to say, oh, it's structurally unsound. Did they check the other buildings?
Yeah, right. No, I believe it. I believe those guys didn't want to see this building. Yeah. There were also financial problems after the WCTU lost control of the building. After Francis Willard died, pretty soon they couldn't, the charge for the property itself in that business district was really high, and the WCTU after Francis Willard died is going to go into decline and be replaced by sort of male focused temperance groups like the Annie Saloon League. So like by 1910, they couldn't make payments on that building. So it goes out of their control. So a lot of things happen. It's kind of like, you know, but think about it. Has anyone since then built a skyscraper for women? Like even today, we can't do that. Yeah, can't do it. Yeah, so.
Okay. This is really out in left field, but the Daughters of the American Revolution, a completely different organization, but I know my grandmother was very active in Pittsburgh, and she was, in fact, both my great-grandmother was very active, and then her daughter, my grandmother, at that time, they were some of the first women to go to college in Oberlin. And again, I never met her, never knew it, but Daughters of American Revolution, is that another woman's organization that was, I know she was a spitfire. I've read some articles on it here in Pittsburgh and was always talking about it. Was it, I think their theme was totally different. I think it was a patriotic theme, but is there any parallels there to an organization like that?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. The Daughters of the American Revolution was another really large group. It was you know, only a fraction as large as the WCTU got, but it was a very important group. And I will say that Francis Willard's brother went to Oberlin. So you have Oberlin was definitely a huge... Yeah, I think there was probably a lot of many people who were in both organizations, who were in the Daughters of the American Revolution and also the WCTU. There was probably a huge amount of, she was probably a WCTU person as well. You know, so. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No. No, and I do want to say that in the leadership, you have a lot of single women, but in the membership, right, it's just going to be like women, you know, in all walks of life. But yeah, no, there were many other, you know, women's organizations at the time. They just weren't, and there were many other that came to be nationally organized at this time. The Dada Revolution is a really good example of that. But yeah, again, not quite as rights focused. Yeah, but that's cool.
By just that it's in called the temple, the women's temple.
Yeah.
Like a church or where you worship or a synagogue or.
Yeah. I don't know how they came up with, or it almost seems Greek or something like that. You know, I'm not quite sure. I mean, Frances Willard was, you know, as we mentioned before, very serious about Christianity. And the group itself was very focused on Christianity. So yeah, it's true. The temple is kind of an unusual, you know, this is a real question. When did the Temple of Learning go up here? I don't know. When did the Temple of Learning go up?
The Cathedral of Learning.
Oh, it is. Oh, shoot. That's not it then. Yeah. Yeah.
So we're on that, I just wonder that makes me wonder, okay, so what was Frances Willard's theology? How did she view things like the role of Mary in the church and, you know, all of the things that kind of flow from questions of the patriarchy in Christianity versus the role of Mary in the Catholic Church and so on?
Yeah, no, I haven't. She doesn't write very much. I mean, I mentioned that she went on the road with Dwight Lyman Moody, a kind of famous sort of the founder of fundamentalism, right? You know, Moody Bible College and stuff like that. So she definitely had theological, you know, she delivered sermons. In her own writing, like when you read her WCTU addresses or when you read her Glimpses book, she doesn't really talk very much at all about formal theology. She really doesn't. So I can't, like, I feel like she doesn't really talk much about, you know, Mary or, you know, anything like that. So that is interesting. The women's suffrage people were really interested in Greece. And they actually sort of like, you know, some of them like learned Greek. Some of them were actually attempting at this time to sort of reread biblical texts to sort of see if they could make Paul more friendly to women's rights, you know. So you actually had like Elizabeth Cady Stanton was in there putting out something called the Woman's Bible, where she found sort of women who could read Greek. And this is right at that same time, right? And these women are like, well, actually, when Paul says women don't speak in church, he was saying women don't screech in church, you know, or, you know, things like that, that, you know, she's like saying, well, maybe we can like find a more woman-friendly Paul, right? You know, is kind of what they're trying to do. Yeah. So, I mean, it's possible that Frances Willard was also that the temple might've had a sort of Greek reference too. I'm not sure. Yeah.
I'm thinking about the temple and the fact that the question of the temple. Now, there's the Masonic temple, and the Masonic, that's a man, that's very much a man's organization, or at least I always thought it was, but it's not really a religious organization. It's not, I think there might be some qualification, but it's not, that's not its focus. It's more like a social club, I think. And so is this a parallel to that? I'm just curious about the choice of the word temple, because that is something we think of as a religious facility.
I mean, it might be. And the Masons were really at a peak in the 1890s. You know, they were, you know, Masons are still around and like an important part of our world, but in the 1890s, they were huge, right? It was really, so, you know, that's possible.
the mirror of that then?
Yeah, I don't really know where they get the word temple. It is a really interesting question, but the Masonic theory isn't a bad one. Mm-hmm. This is going to be our temple.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? What a fascinating lecture. Thank you so much.
Thank you.